desk and sat down next to him. "What have you been told about this?" I asked. "The neurologist said it was benign," he replied, "and that it was up to you as to whether it should be removed or not." "Well, it's certainly benign, but it's also very large," I said. "But they grow very slowly, so we know it's been there for many years already. What led you to having the scan in the first place?" He told me how he had noticed that his walking had slowly been becoming a little unsteady in recent years, and that he was also starting to lose hearing in his left ear. "But what will happen if it stays there?" his son asked. I replied cautiously, telling them that it would go on growing slowly and that he would slowly deteriorate. "I've already decided to take early retirement on medical grounds," he said. I explained that surgery was not without risks. "What sort of risks?" asked the son. I told them that the risks were very serious. There were so many brain structures involved with the tumour that the dangers of surgery range from deafness or facial paralysis to death or a major stroke. I described what surgery would involve. The three of them sat in silence for a while. "I've been in contact with Professor B in America," the son said. "He said it should be operated upon, and he said he could do it." I was not sure what to say. I was only at the beginning of my consultant career and knew that other surgeons were more experienced than I was. In those years, I was in awe of the big names of international neurosurgery, who you could hear giving keynote lectures at conferences where they showed cases like the man in front of me, and the amazing results they achieved, quite beyond anything that I had yet done. "But it would cost over $100,000, the patient's wife added, "and we can't afford that." The son looked a little embarrassed. "We're told that Professor M is the best neurosurgeon in the country," he said, "and we're going to see him for a second opinion." I felt humiliated, but knew that any operation was going to be exceptionally difficult. "That's a good idea," I said. "I'd be very interested to hear what he thinks." They left the room, and I continued with my outpatient clinic. "I've got Professor M on the line for you," said Gail 2 weeks later, looking into my office. I picked up my phone to hear the professor's booming, confident voice. I had known him briefly when I was a trainee, and he was certainly a superb surgeon whom all the trainees hoped to emulate. Self-doubt had never seemed to be one of his weaknesses. I had heard that he would soon be retiring. "Ah, Henry," he said. "This chap with the petroclival needs to come out. He's starting to have some difficulties with swallowing, so it's only a matter of time before he gets aspiration pneumonia, and that'll be the end of him. It's a young man's operation. I've told them you should do it." "Thank you very much, Prof," I replied, a little surprised but delighted to have been given what felt like a papal dispensation. So I made arrangements for the operation, which I expected to be a long one. This was many years ago, when hospitals were different places, and all I had to do was ask the theatre staff and anaesthetists to stay on longer than usual. There were no managers whose permission had to be sought. The operation started in an almost festive spirit. This was man-sized brain surgery. A real big hit, as the American registrar assisting me put it. As we opened the man's head, we talked about the big names of neurosurgery in America. "Prof B's a really fantastic surgeon, amazing technician," my registrar said. "But do you know what he was called by his residents before he moved to his present job? They called him the Butcher, because he trashed so many patients as he perfected his technique with these really difficult cases. And he still gets some terrible complications. Doesn't seem to trouble him much, though." It's one of the painful truths about neurosurgery that you only get good at doing the really difficult cases if you get lots of practice. But that means making lots of mistakes at first and leaving a trail of injured patients behind you. I suspect that you've got to be a bit of a psychopath to carry on, or at least have a pretty thick skin. If you're a nice doctor, you'll probably give up, let nature take its course and stick to the simpler cases. My old boss, who was really nice, the one who operated on my son, used to say, "If the patient's going to be damaged, I'd rather let God do the damage than do it myself." In the US, my registrar continued, "We're a bit more can-do, but we have a commercial healthcare system, and nobody can afford to admit to making mistakes." The first few hours of the operation went perfectly. We slowly removed more and more of the tumour, and by midnight, after 15 hours of operating, it looked as though most of it was out and the cranial nerves were not damaged. I started to feel that I was joining the ranks of the really big neurosurgeons. I would stop every hour or two and join the nurses in the staff room and have something to eat and drink from the box I had brought and smoke a cigarette. I stopped smoking some years later. It was all very convivial. Music played continuously while we operated. I had brought all sorts of CDs in that morning, ranging from Bach to ABBA to African music. In the old hospital, I always listened to music when operating, and although my colleagues found some of my choices a little strange, they seemed to like it, especially what we called closing music, which meant playing Chuck Berry or B.B. King or other fast rock or blues music when stitching up a patient's head. I should have stopped at that point and left the last piece of tumour behind, but I wanted to be able to say that I had removed all of the tumour. The post-operative scans, shown by the big international names when they gave their keynote lectures, never showed residual tumour, so surely this was the right thing to do, even if it involved some risk. As I started to remove the last part of the tumour, I tore a small perforating branch off the bacilla artery, a vessel the width of a thick pin. A narrow jet of bright red arterial blood started to pump upwards. I knew at once that this was a catastrophe. The blood loss was trivial and easy enough to stop, but the damage to the brain stem was terrible. The bacilla artery is the artery that keeps the brain stem alive, and it is the brain stem that keeps the rest of the brain awake. As a result, the patient never woke up, and that was why, 7 years later, I saw him curled into a sad ball on a bed in the nursing home. I will not describe the pain of seeing his unconscious form on the ITU for many weeks after the operation. To be honest, I cannot remember it well now. The memory has been overlain by other, more recent tragedies. But I do remember many anguished conversations with the family as we all hoped against hope that he would wake up again one day. It is an experience unique to neurosurgeons, and one with which all neurosurgeons are familiar. With other surgical specialties, on the whole, the patients either die or recover, and do not linger on the ward for months. It is not something we discuss among ourselves, other than perhaps to sigh and nod your head when you hear of such a case. But at least you know that somebody understands what you feel. A few seem to be able to shrug it off, but they are a minority. Perhaps they are the ones who will become great neurosurgeons. Eventually, the poor man was sent back to his local hospital, still in a coma but no longer on a ventilator, and at some point he had been sent on to a nursing home where he had remained ever since. This was the man I had seen and scarcely recognized on my visit to see the girl with akinetic mutism. For the next few years, whenever I saw similar cases, which was only on a few occasions, I deemed the tumors inoperable and left the unfortunate patients to go elsewhere or to have radiation treatment, which is not very effective for very large tumors of this kind. These